Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast Discover North Korea. I'm your host, Zoe, from Zoe Discovers. And if you're watching on YouTube, then you will note that we are recording the video today. So it's not just audio, but it also is visual. So if you do fancy watching that, you can hop on over to YouTube. I am not alone on the podcast today, but I'm about to be joined by a very special guest. He's been to North Korea multiple times as a tourist and even more times as a freelance tour guide, going a massive 6 times in 2019 alone. But there's one place in the DPRK that holds a special place in his heart, and we'll chat a bit about that today and reveal where that might be. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, you will be able to tell that my hair is very wet, and this is due to the fact that the aircon is broken where I currently live, and it's currently at like 38 degrees. I have 2 fans on me, so, and I've got like wet hair to try and cool myself down. So if you hear any background noise, that's probably it. I do apologize for that in advance. Before we get stuck in and say hello to our guest, do remember to like or rate or do whatever you can about this podcast. If you haven't already, it does mean a lot to me, honestly, and feel free to follow me on whatever social media channels you use, TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, all the things. You can find me on Zoe Discovers or Zoe Discovers NK. Email me your questions, guest recommendations, comments, whatever on zoediscovers@gmail.com. And before we go, I did promise that I would tell you about a super extra special giveaway that I'm currently doing on YouTube and Instagram. Let me tell you about that quickly. It's basically, head over to my YouTube video, my most recent YouTube video. It's actually a pretty cool video, if I do say so myself, just 10 minutes long. And the giveaway details are about like 10 minutes, 55 seconds in. It's super simple. Basically, all you have to do is like make a couple of comments on like YouTube and Instagram to be in the chance to win a North Korea calendar for 2023. I know that it's already July and over half the year is over, but nevertheless, I still think it's a pretty cool gift. And I managed to get hold of a couple recently. One of them is going to my patrons and one of them is going to one of you guys. The competition is going to be on for a whole week now until the 8th. Super simple entry. Head over to the YouTube video to find out more. The link will be in the show notes. And without further ado, let's welcome Pete to the show. So, Pete, welcome to the podcast. So nice to have you on and so nice to be able to actually catch up. It's been a while. Before I get into when we last saw each other and stuff like that, do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners who haven't heard from you before?
Great, yeah, Zoe, it's really good to see you again and have a catch up. So we know each other from our time at Koryo Tours. Prior to living in the UK, where I am now, I spent a lot of time in China. I was there from 2010 to 2020. And during that time, I made several visits to the DPRK, most of which were as a freelance tour leader for Koryo Tours. So I believe we first met each other in 2019, or perhaps it was even 2017 during the Pyongyang Marathon Tour.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, we've been to North Korea together more than a handful of times, and
Yeah.
it's really good to be chatting today.
Definitely. But we might have seen each other in the 2017 Pyongyang Marathon. I wasn't working for Korea Tours then. I was with a
Right.
different tour company. But we might have seen each other in Pyongyang, interestingly enough. But yeah, definitely saw each other a lot in 2019. That was really nice. And our last tour together actually was the 2019 to 2020 New Year's Eve tour, which will always stay in my mind. I don't know how much like it stays in your mind, but like it'll always stay in my mind as like one of the best tours, one of my best times of my life, to be honest. Definitely one of my best New Year's. I don't know if you've had any great New Year's Eves since, but for me, I don't know, especially during COVID, it's been all a bit rubbish. So it was definitely a night to remember of some people who've maybe consumed too much alcohol. I don't remember it all too well,
Yeah.
but no, it was a great
No,
time.
it was epic. I
Yeah.
remember, yeah, seeing you there. I've got a 1 second a day video diary, so
I remember you
every
doing
day
that.
I record a second. Yeah, and your face and a few other people feature in my countdown from like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 towards New Year, and then we have the nice fireworks over Pyongyang, which is a
Yay.
pretty nice memory.
Oh, that's so good. And I remember you telling me about this 1 second a day thing that you do. And I was like, I'm gonna do that. And then I'm pretty sure I started it in 2020. I don't downloaded the app. I started it in 2020. But then COVID happened and I was like, I don't want to record any of this. Life is rubbish.
Right.
Yeah, never mind. I was gonna say, on your just because you said you were in China from 2010. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about before we get into the North Korea stuff. People might be curious what you were doing in China, in 2010, because that's already over. It's over 10 years ago, which doesn't sound like a long time, but I think in China terms, a lot has changed in China over the 10 years. It changed even when I was living there since like 2016, 2017 time. What were you doing in China in 2010? Why did you stay there so long? And did you notice any big changes? And have you been back since the borders have opened since COVID, since lockdown?
Yeah, so I started out in China through a program that was arranged by the British Council, an English teaching program. And this is an organization, for those that aren't aware of the British Council, it's a UK cultural relations organization, kind of similar to the Peace Corps in the US, in that they send people overseas to teach English as a way of building relationships between the UK and other countries. So I applied for that when I was at uni, and was accepted to go on to the cohort that arrived in the summer of 2010. So I started out in China teaching English with the British Council, was posted down to Guangzhou. It was real adventure. I originally planned on staying in China for a single year, treating this as like a post-university gap year, but I kind of caught the bug in that first year and realized I just scratched the surface of what China was able to offer. So that led to more teaching work in the years that followed. And then from 2014, after I'd spent a bit of time learning Chinese, I got a job at the British Embassy, so moved up to Beijing. And then the rest of my time in China from 2014 through to 2020 was spent working for the embassy, working for the British consulate in Wuhan, and then working for a company that was doing UK-China trade and investment work after that.
Wow, very interesting. Very cool. And did you see big differences between like Beijing and Guangzhou and stuff, or which ones would you prefer? Are you a North China kind of guy or a South China kind of
Oh, that's a good question.
guy?
Probably a North China
Yeah.
kind of guy overall, but
Food wise,
yeah,
people
I appreciate
wise, city
elements of both.
wise.
That's a great question. Like food wise, maybe. And there's something a bit more rugged about the North that I'm drawn
Interesting.
to.
Yeah.
Like it's a bit more it's a bit of a harder place in terms of like the weather and stuff, which can be a challenge sometimes. But I sometimes that kind of adventurous side is nice. And then the other element that's quite important is language. But I'm quite into the Chinese language, as I know you are. And so to be in the north, you tend to encounter much more standard accents there. So it's easier to talk and interact with people on their own terms rather than like making them speak Putonghua rather than their local dialect.
Yeah, true. And I have to say, being in Taiwan, like I miss the Beijing accent a lot, or the North Chinese accent, like the Northeast Dongbei kind of accent. It's very thick and kind of, in a way, I always describe it like this, and people look at me like, what? But I always describe the Beijing accent as like a pirate accent, because you're always adding the R in at the end of words and stuff. Well, and Taiwan is very soft, like the south, and you know, it's absolutely fine as well. For me, I just prefer, as you said, like the rugged kind of northeast, northern kind of feel. And have you been back to China yet?
Unfortunately not. I would have loved to have gone back by now. China still doesn't allow tourist visas, so I'd have to either kind of have another reason to go, which I may have some reasons to get a business visa, which is good for later this year. So that could be an opportunity to go back. But yeah, I haven't been able to yet. And it feels really weird, because I left Beijing on 29th of January 2020, just as COVID was starting to escalate and all of the international travel restrictions started coming in. Airlines started shutting down flights to China. So I originally didn't foresee that this was going to be such a long process. So I had a trip planned back to the UK, and I decided to go for it, thinking maybe I'll get a bit delayed, but it's not going to be that long until I get back to China. And I haven't been back since then, which is coming up to 3.5 years. And, you know, I was living there. I spent 4 years there in Beijing. So a lot of people, a lot of friends there that I didn't get to properly say goodbye to. So it would be great to go back, and hopefully I can do that later this year.
I can definitely relate to that. And did you leave all your stuff behind there? And I know you're a bit of a minimalist, but did you have a lot of stuff? Have you been able to get?
Well, that was the lucky thing. I'd done this like minimalist drive with all of my stuff in the months prior. So it's a weird coincidence, like a Marie Kondo style thing, where I was really trying to see how much I could limit the physical things I had and digitize things so that I didn't have to have lots of possessions and I could travel easily. So actually, I really went far with that, and I was able to fit all of my possessions in the suitcases that I took on the flight. And because I thought there is a chance this is going to be a longer thing, I decided to take everything that I had. So I literally took everything I had back to the UK. And actually, another tour leader from the DPRK, Peyton, he moved into my previous flat. We were kind of arranging this in like the weeks prior to that. So I kind of had a person that I was building up to hand over to anyway. So it meant that, I don't have any physical stuff there, but it's just really like the relationships that I had to leave behind. And that was kind of a challenge, actually. I'm sure it was for you.
Yeah, definitely. And it was amazing going back for me. Like, I hope you can get back. Surely you'll be able to get back this year. I mean, you know, we've been saying that surely this year, but I hope, because it seemed very normal. Like when I went back, luckily my visa was still valid. Like I have a 5-year visa and it was still valid from like pre-COVID. So that's how I was able to go back. because like you said, like they're not issuing at the moment. And I was really nervous about going back and worried what kind of China, what kind of Beijing I'd be going back to, because I really love Beijing. I just love so much about it. And I was really worried that it had changed a lot. And honestly, I got back and it hadn't changed anything. And I realized the weight of those words when I say it, because I didn't go through the past 3 years like a Chinese person in Beijing did, or like a foreigner in Beijing did. I can imagine it's been like very tough with constant lockdowns and testing every day and not knowing when you have to, but it's like all of that never happened. Like, you go back and everything's normal, no one's wearing masks. Really weirdly enough, when I went back, you didn't have to wear masks at all. And Taiwan still had a mask mandate. Like, I got back to Taiwan and I like had a mask like half on when I was getting on the tube. Like, I just forgot about it. And this woman came up to me and was like, make sure to wear your mask properly. And I'm like, man, I just came back from China and now like Taiwan's even more strict. Yeah. So anyway, I hope you get back soon. And it'll still be the Beijing you know and love, hopefully.
Yeah, no, I listened to your episode where you talked about coming back to Beijing. And it was really encouraging, actually, because I think a lot of us during the pandemic felt like the world was changing into this much more severe and controlled place. And that was what was happening in China was definitely a radical change from what we were all used to in 2019 and the years before. So, you know, regardless of what people think, it's obviously quite a controversial topic, you know, how countries dealt with COVID.
Yeah.
But there is something nice, I think we can all agree, about being able to see the face of another human being in public and being able to go around, travel freely. And it was encouraging to hear that, like, lots of the things that we all loved about China in 2019, the years before, have now returned. With some cool upgrades, like the train ticketing system that you mentioned, no more queues at Beijing Airport.
Amazing. Get ready
so,
for that.
I'm maybe really enthusiastic about getting back and seeing the old China again.
Definitely. And so it was in Beijing, I guess, in the China context, that you then got interested in the North Korea stuff, right? Like, I guess previously, when travel was a bit more free and stuff like that, if you lived in Beijing, it was a kind of normal thing to be like, oh, okay, like, I'll just hop over to the DPRK. Like, it doesn't seem like such a sensationalized thing when you already live in Beijing and it's so easy to go over to the DPRK and no one really, you know, you don't have the Western media constantly around you and stuff, like, kind of sensationalizing it. It's a kind of, a lot of expats in Beijing go to DPRK, right? And is that how you kind of, how did North Korea get on your radar?
The first time I heard about it was through the British Council, actually.
Oh, that's cool.
Because it was one of those things where people knew that this was the Beijing, where we did our two-week training in 2010, was the stopping off point for the DPRK. Mm. So there are a few people in our cohort that had been talking about going. And the idea of going had appealed to me since I was a teenager. Some people have, like, you know, everyone has a slightly different rationale for wanting to go to the DPRK.
Yeah.
And honestly, for me, the thing was, at school, I was quite interested in history and quite interested in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that there was this, in the 20th century, there was this political ideology that seemed quite alien and different to what I was used to. The idea that this ideology had shaped maybe a third of the world's population in terms of political systems and the political systems that the countries had adopted. I found that really intriguing. And I was like, okay, what remains of it today? And there are only about five countries left that still have a nominally communist system. And the DPRK is the one that has probably the best preserved, closest to what was in place in the Soviet Union. So the idea of going there and seeing what that's like was always really appealing. And it was really just a matter of funds. When I was in Guangzhou, my salary was 4,500 RMB a month. So about, in pounds, like £500 a month or $600 a month.
Yeah.
So spending 1,000 euros to go to the DPRK was not financially viable.
Yep.
So it was only when I, like, got to Beijing and I had a quote unquote proper job that I was like, right, this is now possible. So
it's one of the first things I did
after getting a job at the embassy.
Okay. Pretty cool. Nice. And you first went, so let's talk about your tourist trips a little bit, because you didn't just take one tourist trip, right? But where is your first tourist trip? And tell us a little bit about that.
So the first tourist trip was one of the first I could get when moving to Beijing. So I moved to Beijing in, I think it was June or July 2014.
Would have been hot. Like me in Taiwan right now, like 30, 35 degrees. Yeah.
Yeah. And I went on the China National Day tour because that was a tour that I could do when we had some time off from work. Yeah. So I didn't have to take too much extra annual leave to do it.
Tours like that are actually targeted at people like you who are expats working in China. So target market success.
Target market success. That was it.
Yeah.
And I think it was a 4 or 5 night tour. It was a fairly standard tour. So it took in Pyongyang, did a visit to Kaesong and the DMZ, and we went out on the train. And it's very different to what I expected. Some ways, well, I mean, I expected it to be quite like the Soviet Union in that there would be pictures of Karl Marx everywhere and like a clear, coherent philosophy, because the Soviet Union in its approach to communism was quite internationalist. It wasn't necessarily about promoting one particular ethnic group over others. There were lots of different nationalities in the Soviet Union and they were very internationalist. They did a lot of their propaganda was about spreading the revolution to the world. And in Korea, I found that it was that you never saw a picture of Karl Marx. I think there was one in Kim Il-sung Square until about 2010 or...
Yeah, they used to be.
10, but... 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there was none of that. So from that sort of political side, that was something I noticed. Mm-hmm. And then I think a lot of the things that you often highlight in your podcast were very apparent to me as well. Like... It's a much lighter place than you would expect. It's a more fun place than you would expect. Mm-hmm. A lot of the messaging we get in the media about the DPRK relates to nuclear tests, some of the human rights issues that there are, the restrictions that there are on people's freedoms. So you expect it to be a very severe and strict place. And when you arrive, you find that the vibe is much more lighthearted and fun than you'd expect. So to experience the country in that kind of environment and with Corio Tours, just to give a plug to our organization. Thanks. I wasn't working for Corio at the time, but Corio were just excellent at, from the moment we arrived in Beijing and had the pre-departure briefing. I think my first pre-departure briefing was with Rich. It was just exciting from the moment we started, because we knew we were doing something that was regarded as pretty adventurous, but also we were in good hands. So arriving in Beijing, having that briefing, understanding what we were doing, being able to experience that in the office around all of this North Korean art, and
such a cool office as well.
In really good hands was like a really good way of kicking things off.
Yeah, and for people that don't know, so Rich is our international tour leader, expert at Corio Tours. He does like the Mongolia stuff, and he's currently living in Mongolia as well. Very, very, absolutely lovely guy. Knows his stuff for sure. And whilst we're plugging Corio Tours, I think what you said is it's totally true. Like, they really stand out. I mean, I'm totally biased when I say this, full disclosure, obviously. But, they really stand out from the other tour companies because they have over 30 years of experience working in the country. They were the ones that kind of pioneered opening it and starting the tours and helped to open the country out more. So you do definitely feel like you're in safe hands. I mean, I am totally biased, but I'm glad that that came off to you as well. It's not just me that says it. Then you went into Pyongyang. Where did your tour take you? You went in by the train, and would you suggest that that's a good idea for the people going there first? Because that was always
that. We went out by train, but we went in by flight. So yeah, it was the Air Corio flight to get in.
Yeah,
and I think that's a great way of doing it. Going in. Yeah, it depends what you're looking for. I can see the benefit in both. I've done both. I've done coming in on the train and flying in. Personally, I was just keen to get into the action.
Right.
So it worked well. Mm. It meant that you didn't arrive. The problem with the train, I think, coming in is that because the tours are so intense in terms of your time. Like everything is, you know, people want to make the most of the time because it's valuable. And we've come all the way across the world. There's so much to see and do. So rightly, you know, we cram a lot in, but that means that you need to get your rest. So one disadvantage of the train is you might come arriving a little bit tighter than you really would like to be.
That's true. Yeah.
But so eliminating that on the way in through flying and experiencing Air Korea as well, which is a unique airline.
Yes.
Is also
a good way to describe it. Yeah. And then you did four nights, did you say? Five nights?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly. Okay, I think it was four or five nights.
So I'm presuming that you went to Pyongyang and then did the DMZ and then maybe another city or two?
It wasn't another city or two on the first, on that tour.
Okay.
It's hard to remember because there's been so many trips and I'm trying to remember what
maybe
we did.
Maybe you passed Sariwon or Kaesong or something at least, right? On your way to DMZ, maybe. Yeah. It's don't worry.
We definitely spent a night in Kaesong.
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think maybe there was a trip to Nampo, but...
Ah, nice, yeah. My favorite place, yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
And then you loved your tour so much that you then decided that you would go back. And this is something that I would say, I don't know about in your experience as a tour leader, but like I would say a surprising amount of people actually go back for a second or third tour. I mean, like people would expect that it's a once in a lifetime, you know, people generally only go there once, but there's actually quite a few people that go there twice or three times, no? And what was your motivating factor? And where did you go for your second tour? Talk us through that a little bit.
So in a way similar to China, going in there, I felt like I've just got under the skin of this really interesting country. There were lots of things about the experience that I liked. Mm-hmm. So initially, I was really against the idea of being in a group, doing a group tour.
So many people are. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And because personally, I'm quite a free spirit, mm-hmm. and I like the idea, if I go and travel, I like to just walk around a neighborhood in a foreign place and get my bearings and see what people are doing, you know, in their everyday life, rather than go and see all the quote unquote sights.
Yeah.
Like I'm more interested in getting under the skin of what daily life is like.
Yeah. I'd happily just like sit in a coffee shop and watch people watch, you know, or like just walk around and get lost. And I get so much more out of that than going to a museum. So I totally get
right. Yeah. Just going along, seeing what looks good, seeing where there's a vibe, seeing where people like you see a line of people queuing for something, you're like, why are they queuing? You can check that out. Or even getting on a random bus where you don't know where it's heading.
Yeah.
Just to see where you end up and adding serendipity into your travel plans in that way.
Definitely. Yeah.
So I've been drawn to that quite a lot in the past. But in the end, I ended up really liking this group tour dynamic, which totally surprised me because there's something really cool about experiencing something as different as North Korea with other people, especially when it's like the most international group you're likely to be in ever.
Yeah.
So my group, we had like people from Thailand, Germany, the US, so this was pre-travel ban, Canada, a couple of other bits in Asia, China. So you had all of these people from across the world that were thrown together and experiencing this very alien culture simultaneously. And as I mentioned, it's quite a lighthearted and fun environment. So there were all kinds of jokes. There were different characters in the group that emerged. Mm-hmm. There were some people that were really like punctual and some people that were always a few minutes late. And you just very quickly develop a rapport with the group. And I found that experience, it's like a fast track to becoming really good friends with people. So I've ended up staying in touch with loads of my fellow tourists or people that I've led on tours over time.
Oh, that's so nice.
So that appealed to me. Yeah. So that appealed to me. And I just thought, look, there's much more to see here. Mm-hmm. And then the idea of going somewhere that's like, so my second tour was a Northeastern Adventure Tour. up in North Hamgyong province in Rasong. So the idea of going somewhere that was like even more remote and even less visited was also definitely an appealing
right aspect of this. You're just speaking about the just to go back to the tour group stuff, like it's just made me really miss being on tour. I miss being a tour guide, and like, I mean, there's not a day when I don't miss it, but like talking about that, I mean, it really is. I think this is why you get so close to the guides as well, because when you're on a tour to North Korea, like you're all going through the same thing, first of all, and then you're all bound by one, at least one thing that you all have in common, and that's the fact that you all decided to go to North Korea, which is, you know, set you aside from the rest in the first place anyway. There's something a bit weird about you anyway, weird in a good way. And then there's like, you're spending 24/7 together, you know, apart from when you're asleep. These tours are intense, and you get up at like 6 o'clock and you're having breakfast by like 7 or 8, and then you're out the whole day, and you just, you're tired together, but you're experiencing so much, and you do really, you go through a lot. And then with the guides, it's even more intense because you're doing all of that. But then after everyone's going to chill out in the evening, then you've got to actually work with the guides and like plan and what's going on the next day and stuff. And I'm sure you can relate to that. We'll go into your, how you became a tour leader and stuff like that later. But yeah, just, I really miss being on tour. I hope it can start back up again soon. So you went to the Northeast, which is a very cool place. We spoke on the podcast, I can't remember which episode it was, but a couple of episodes back on Rasan, which is the special economic zone. I'm going to pick your brains about that in a minute, because I think you have a little bit more knowledge actually on special economic zones than I do. But maybe you can tell us, first of all, what your tour in the Northeast was like, how long you went there, what kind of sites did you see, and also how it differed from Pyongyang and their first tour.
Yeah, very different vibe to the first tour. So the Northeast Adventure Tour, I did that roughly a year later. So the dates for that were, I think, the 19th to the 27th of October in 2015. So that was 7 nights in DPRK, 1 night in Yanji. So
very cool. The immediate city as
difference.
Well. Sorry? Very cool city, Yanji is. Like, very interesting, weird city. As well, yeah.
Yanji in itself is a really interesting place just to visit.
Yeah.
And that in itself gives the tour a different feel. I would say, I think you've expressed this view as well in your podcast, that it's probably not one that you want to do as your first tour, because the experience of starting off in Beijing, especially if you haven't visited China before, like China itself is an amazing.
It's intense, yeah.
The interesting place to visit if you're, if you're the first time in this region. So. To start off in Beijing, to get the pre-departure briefing like properly done with choreo, to meet your other participants in the tour, that's a really nice start. And then you're like from Beijing to Pyongyang. So this Northeastern tour, you start off in Yanji. So for listeners that aren't aware of what Yanji is, it's an Korean autonomous prefecture within Jilin province, which borders, it's one of the three provinces that borders the DPRK.
Which is in China.
Which is in China, yeah. So this region, as a Korean autonomous prefecture, it has, one of the first things you'll notice is that there is dual language signage. So there's both Korean and Chinese on the signage. Honestly, most people are speaking Mandarin when you go around and just listen to what people are speaking on the street, which is kind of expected, just in China. But if you do go to certain places, particularly like Korean restaurants, you hear Korean being spoken. And there's a lot of people that are ethnically Korean that move there. In fact, like a lot of DPRK citizens that have left the DPRK have ended up in this place. And Shenyang is another one. So you're kind of getting this transition towards DPRK. You're staying at a place that's a bit more Korean, and it's worth just checking out, like seeing. I personally find these kinds of places really interesting. Like one of my favorite cities in the world is Hong Kong, because I like the way that the sort of British cultures interact with the Chinese culture. So if you like cultural interactions, Yanji is quite a cool place to kick things off.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison, actually. Because I dislike Hong Kong, but I don't dislike it for that reason. I dislike it for the fact that it's cramped and expensive. But when you say it like that, it is very interesting to see the play of the two cultures. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. So from Yanji, where did you go?
So you spend the first night in Yanji in it was a hotel called the Ruyigong Hotel, so not the famous triangular one in the DPRK in Pyongyang, but another similarly named one, and that's where we met our fellow tourists. And this area is definitely a lot less developed than what you're going to get in Beijing, or even, well, not
Maybe even
Pyongyang, but
Pyongyang,
on
yeah,
the DPRK side. So
true.
the equivalent of Yanji to Beijing is like Yanji is much less developed, I guess, much less international. And then you cross over the border, an area called the Tumen River Crossing, which is a river crossing, a border crossing that dates back to the Japanese colonial era. So that's been there for quite a long time. It was one of the crossings that the People's Volunteer Army used when they were assisting the Koreans during the Korean War. So there's a bit of history to the crossing itself.
Wow.
And then you get onto to Onsong, and you do notice as soon as you get to the DPRK side, there's an immediate difference. There's like quite a lonely looking sentry guard that will check your visas. As you've mentioned before in your podcast, this is also a place where if you do want to get that DPRK stamp in your passport, this is the place that you can get it done.
Did you get
So
it?
this guy will look at your passport and stamp the passport if you want the passport stamped.
Did anyone refuse it? Did anyone say, like, I don't want the passport stamp, and he didn't stamp it?
I think on my tour, no. I think everyone got it on my
Yeah.
tour.
Okay.
So one of the things you do notice in it's so when you enter the DPRK from the Tumen River Crossing, you're in an area called Onsong, and that's part of North Hamgyong Province, which is a region in the far northeast of the DPRK, population about 2.3 million. So this region is known for being the poorest region of the DPRK. It's a region that quite a lot of people defect from. I read an article somewhere that actually half of the defectors from Korea, people that leave the DPRK, are from this province. And
I
so when
guess
you hear
that's,
accounts,
yeah.
sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, I guess that's for the two reasons, the proximity towards China and the Tumen River crossing, and then also the fact that it's, one of the poorest places.
Yeah, so partly because the conditions there are pretty tough, partly due to the fact that that part of the Tumen River freezes over in the winter, so people can cross over without having to use the official crossings. And so when we hear accounts of what the DPRK is like, they're often quite harsh accounts. And some people have argued that one of the reasons for that is that most people come from this specific part. Like the population of the DPRK today is just under 26 million. So this is just like 10% of the overall population. So it's not, the entire country's not like this, but it's something to bear in mind. If you're going to this part of the DPRK, you're going to a poorer bit. And there are very few paved roads, for example, in that region. So when you get over, you're on single lane roads, often on dirt roads. You're bumping around a lot to get from one
Free
destination to
massage.
another. Yeah,
That
free massage.
the guides say.
Yep. And the sites there are, there's some really like impressive sites that you can see. Like the Wangjaesan Monument, this really impressive bronze monument that's one of the first sites you'll see on a tour of the northeast if you cross in from Tumen. But generally speaking, there's a lot of countryside, there's a lot more poverty. And you will see that out of the window of the bus. You've noticed people are probably a bit shorter there than they are in the rest of the DPRK, because it's the area of the DPRK that was worst hit by the famine in the 1990s. and that led to malnutrition and some issues. So that's just, you know, painting a picture of the vibe when you get over. Now, that's something you're probably going to notice if you've done like Pyongyang and you've been to other parts of the DPRK. But yeah, other than that, there's loads of great things that you can be doing there. So the North Hamgyong province is home to Mount Chilbor, which is
my favorite.
An amazing mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, about 1,000 meters high, this mountain, and it's really picturesque. We went there in autumn, so there was this lovely coloring to the trees when we went. And it was like, you know, you feel like you're off the beaten track, but you're experiencing something that's really special and not visited. So yeah, you've got Mount Chilbor, you've got Chongjin, you've got Hoyong City. There's a few different places that you can go on this tour, and yeah, it's a really special thing.
Yeah. Did you manage to you didn't stay in the homestay when you were there?
I did, yes.
You did?
That was definitely a highlight.
So that's in just the last episode that I talked about, you know, things that you didn't know that you can do in North Korea. And I think it surprises so many people that you can stay in a homestay in Korea. And I don't know if the way that I tackled this in the podcast does it justice. So what, you know, how did you find the homestay experience in North Korea? Like, did you find it very authentic? Did you find it, yeah, how did you find it? Awkward? Do you speak Korean? You know, like, how was it?
So, yeah, sadly, I don't speak very much Korean at all. It's really something I'd love to have done. When I was living in China, I was very focused on Chinese, and then learning another language seemed like too much. So that is one of the major issues that you have, that the people staying in this homestay village won't speak English very well. Other than there was a child in the family that did speak some English. So basically we interacted through this child, which was a cool part of the experience. Mm-hmm. But to give an idea.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Idea of the vibe. Mm-hmm. I believe this homestay village was created about 10 years ago, and it's not a like really traditional kind of place that people would live. It's created as a special compound where people can come in and make these home visits, but you are staying with Korean families who genuinely do live there all year round, that genuinely farm nearby. And it was cool. I mean, even though we didn't get to have really in-depth conversations with them, there's a certain way that you can communicate by, you know, expressions and signals. They had dinner with us. We got to stay in the home. It had the traditional Korean heated flooring.
Yeah.
We had a lovely bonfire in the evening and sat around. And this was just the tourists for the bonfire. But yeah, we sat around and exchanged some like, you know, really nice stories. So it was really a highlight of the trip, going to this homestay.
Yeah. So you didn't quite manage to get like any in-depth conversations with the North Koreans living there and stuff?
I mean, I didn't, just because like when I've stayed there, I've been on tour and I unfortunately have like, I'm busy trying to look after everyone else. So I've never managed to really connect with the families there. But and it must be hard, you're only staying there like one or two nights. How did you feel with that? Like, there was just too much of a language barrier?
Well, it wasn't too much. It wasn't an issue. I mean, obviously, it would be nice if I did speak fluent Korean and could really like get into some specifics, some in-depth conversations about what their lives were like. But I think what we ended up doing is we had this meal, and then I helped this kid with his English homework, and the parents like watched and paid and were sort of just present there in the moment. And I remember it very fondly. It being really nice. Like, it wasn't the place where I suddenly gained all of these really deep insights into how the DPRK citizens really live, in the sense of like having those deeper conversations, but it was nonetheless like a really valuable experience.
Yeah. And I can imagine if we gave feedback to the Koreans, like, for example, people don't feel like they can connect because there's a language barrier, it would just be one of those things where, you know, we'd give them feedback from the tourists and then the Koreans would be like, oh, okay, well, to make the tourists have a better experience, we have to find people who can speak English. And then you end up getting like educated, more elite people doing this homestay thing, and then the tourists would complain like, oh, these people can speak English, they're not normal North Koreans. And I'm like, it's just whenever you go into a bar and it's empty and people complain that it's empty, like, this is not a real bar. And then you walk into the bar and it's full and people complain that there's nowhere to sit. It's one of those things where I guess it's hard to kind of please everyone. And but never mind. I guess maybe we can prep people more on some good Korean phrases before they go. And so how did you get around in the Northeast? Did you take any internal, you didn't go to Paektusan?
No, unfortunately. No. Okay. Still not been there.
Ah, well, hopefully when, I'm going to ask you in a little bit if you're going to go back into DPRK tourism, let's not get into that yet. But if you do decide to go to North Korea again in whatever capacity, hopefully you can go to Paektusan. But you were getting around in just like the normal tourist bus, like just usual in Pyongyang? Or did you get any internal trains or anything like that?
No trains on this trip. It was all done on the bus.
Okay.
One of the things that I remember is that we had two different companies, because I believe there's a company would do, I think it's KITC deals with North Hamgyong province, and then it's the Rason Travel Company that deals with Rason. So when we crossed over into Rason halfway through the trip, there was a different travel company that took over. I can't remember if it's the same bus or a different bus, but the whole trip was conducted via bus on pretty bumpy roads. Some fairly long stretches, not super long, maybe 3 hours was the biggest stretch we did from Chongjin to Mount Chilbo. All on the bus.
Yeah, and that alone gives you a really big insight. I don't know how it was when you were in the Northeast, but it can be very strict and a little bit more like you would anticipate from a North Korea tour. Did you find it a little bit more strict than Pyongyang? For example, it didn't used to be okay to film outside the bus in the Northeast, even though it was okay in Pyongyang, stuff like that. The locals are less inclined to want to talk to you just because I guess that they're more nervous and stuff like that. But did you notice that kind of strictness at all? And was there anything, you touched on the fact that you saw a bit more poverty and stuff like that, but were you ever not allowed to take photos and stuff like that of certain things?
Yeah. I think at the time we weren't, this is 2015, and it may be the case that things have eased up a bit, but I think at the time they were pretty reluctant for us to take photos out of the bus.
Yeah.
And the general rule in North Hamgyong was like, ask before you take a picture rather than here are the things you should take a picture of. And then you can take a picture of everything else. It was more like, ask permission first.
Yeah.
And so that was one thing that was different.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, the reason for that is partly, I think, because this is a new part of the DPRK to open to tourism. I think North Hamgyong province only opened up in 2014 or 2015. So mm-hmm. it was a very recent thing at the time. And it's frankly still pretty recent. There aren't that many tours that go to this part of the DPRK. So if people are considering going on this tour, you still will be one of, like, you know, the first few hundred foreign tourists that have ever been there, I would imagine. Mm. So Western tourists, that is, there's probably more Chinese tourists that are going there. But
yeah, potentially.
But yeah, there's North Hamyong definitely stricter. Mm-hmm. Then when you get to Rason, things get more relaxed.
Yes, let's get to Rason. I mean, again, I just did an episode on it, but I'm really interested to hear your insight into Rason. Firstly, so I've never driven from Chongjin. You went from Chongjin to Rason or Chilbo to Rason? I'm trying to think where we are on the map.
So we went from Chongjin to Rason.
Yeah. How long is that drive? Do you remember? Because I've never actually done that. I've only entered Rason, like, straight into Rason.
I think that is a couple of hours.
Okay.
But don't hold
me. It's not too.
Yeah. It's definitely a longer journey from Chongjin to Mount Chilbo.
Yeah. And how was Rason? Like, how was your time there? Tell me a little bit about that. It is very, very different in a way. In a good way?
Sure. Just to give a bit of context on what Rason is for listeners that might not be aware or might not have heard your previous podcast. So this is a special economic zone. It was established in 1991 in the DPRK. And the idea of this, I think there was some UN involvement in setting it up. And the idea was that this was going to be a place that kind of modeled the special economic zones in China, mm-hmm. and that it would be a place where the DPRK could experiment with some kind of market liberalization. And in 1991, the DPRK really, like, was a very centrally planned country compared to what it is today. Mm-hmm. After the end of the Korean War, the DPRK economy was quite closed. It received a lot of aid from the Soviet Union and some from China. And so it had this command economy where there wasn't really a free market. There weren't modern markets like the Kwangbok supermarket that we go to today. Everything was, like, allocated to people via rationing systems. And there was, of course, some informal trading that went on, but it was pretty minimal. And the DPRK had kind of seen what happened in China with Shenzhen and some of the other special economic zones, and so wanted to try out some forms of market liberalization. Mm-hmm. Rason initially was really lauded in international media as like, this is a really big development. It's going to lead to the DPRK moving towards a China-type model where they maybe retain, you know, the political centralization but introduce market reforms. Mm-hmm. And there was talks about this attracting up to, I think, like $2 billion of US dollars in the early 1990s. And in the end, I think it attracted about 35 million US dollars. Mm. So really, really a lot lower than they were expecting. Mm. And it's, you know, introduced some reform. So it's the place that, it was the first place in the whole of the DPRK to have a free market where you can buy and sell things. And if you go to Rason, you can visit that market, and that is the only place that foreign tourists can use and spend Korean won in a market setting.
Yeah.
And that's a cool place to visit, and it's got some historical significance because it was the first. Following that, like, lots of other markets sprang up around the DPRK, although they weren't officially allowed, they were officially allowed in Rason. So Rason was, like, the legitimate market.
Yeah, it's definitely a highlight of the tour, is going to that market. And it's a cool place to see both. I mean, you see a lot more. So it's a cool place to visit because you see a lot of cool stuff that they've got on sale. You see a lot of local produce, but then also at the same time, a lot of import stuff from China. And it's, for me, it's so bizarre because everything is in, and this is so very, you know, DPR Korean. You go into the market and you've got a section and you have about 20 ladies and they are all selling you the same thing. And then, you know, maybe it's hats and they're all selling you the exact same hat and everyone's trying to haggle for you to come over and come to their hat stall. And then you walk a little bit along, and then everyone's selling cigarettes, and it's all the same cigarettes, and they'll be all the same prices, and everyone's trying to haggle you to come over. It's very much of a non-capitalist market in a way. It's very like no advertisements for like come here, no special offers and stuff like that. Did you pick up any cool souvenirs and enjoy the market?
I'm trying to think, you know, honestly, I'm not really one for souvenirs being a minimalist. I didn't pick up many myself. I think I may have picked up a notebook or two. But yeah, good tip for people that might go to this market in Rasan is to take your Korean guide with you, because probably the majority of goods in that market are Chinese made rather than DPRK made. So you, if you are someone that's going there because you want to actually buy some cool DPR, made in the DPRK products, then just make sure that you're checking. So I went and I bought some DPRK made notebooks, I think.
That's pretty cool. And that's a very good tip as well, because again, same thing happens in the Kwanbok supermarket. There are some Chinese made things in there, and it helps if you can read Chinese, because then you can tell the difference between Chinese and Korean writing at least. But so many people, like when you go to the market or when you go to Kwanbok supermarket in Pyongyang, I'd say like, feel free to walk around by yourself, guys. But like, you know, I would recommend that you stay in the group or at least stay with the guides so that you know what's going on if you have any questions and stuff like that. And they're like, no, freedom. We want freedom. Like finally, you know, like running off by themselves. And then they come back and they're like, Zoe, look, I got these. And I'm like, cool. You bought yourself a bag of Chinese sweets. Like, nice one. Overpriced, you know, like considering that it would have been a lot cheaper if you'd have bought them in China. So it's one of those, like, I get why people want to walk around by themselves and like suddenly at the opportunity, it must be great. But like, on the other hand, it is also a little bit like, come on, guys. oh, I just lost you there on the internet. No, you're back.
Yeah.
So you didn't pick up anything from the market. That's fine. But you did enjoy the experience. It was a highlight to you, or? Was there any other highlight from Rasan?
Yeah, definitely. Like, as I say, like when I generally travel, like going around a market is like a great activity to see how local people interact with each other and get a feel for the culture. The haggling is kind of fun sometimes as well. It's a great experience. Definitely something that you'll benefit from if you decide to make that trip up to the Northeast.
Yeah. And from someone who has experience or has a bit more knowledge at least with SEZs, would you say that Rasan is a typical one? What marks it as different? Is it successful in what it does? You know, I guess from what you were just saying before, not so much, but does it have any potential?
Right. So special economic zone means different things in different countries. Ah,
interesting.
It's a modern term. Mm-hmm. And basically what it means is a part of the country that has different rules in terms of like regulation and taxation to the rest of the country. So the first modern one was established in Shannon in Ireland, actually, in 1958.
Oh, wow.
But there are now over 5,000 of these across the world. So there was like a big boom that took off in the 2000s, you know, led by examples of the well-known special economic zones like Shenzhen, Dubai International Financial Center. So there's really like a broad degree of how autonomous these zones can be. So something like Shenzhen is probably in the middle of the pack, because Shenzhen, there are like much looser regulations in terms of stuff like labor. There are different taxes for import and export, different regulations for foreign businesses, and protection of foreign investment. So but like the Chinese, like criminal law and all of these, all the basic elements of the Chinese legal system is still the same there. If you go like further along to like what is the most autonomous kind of special economic zone, it would be something like Hong Kong. So nominally part of China, but basically operating like an independent country, in theory at least. People that have been there in the last few years will probably start to challenge that.
Yeah.
But in theory, Hong Kong should be nominally part of China. Defense and foreign policy are dealt with by the Chinese government. But other than that, issues like, aspects like the legal system, the regulation, the currency even, these are all dealt with independently by the Legislative Council in Hong Kong that acts like a de facto parliament. So you've got this like spectrum of different economic, special economic zones, places like Hong Kong, Dubai being like at the far end of that spectrum.
Right.
And I would say Rason is like at the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So there's not a huge amount that you can really officially do in Rason that you can't do in the rest of the DPRK. The notable things are you can have a market. I think it's slightly easier for foreigners to get in to Rason.
Yeah, I think Chinese people. Yeah, Chinese people can have like a day pass, I think.
Right. Okay. So that would be another difference. It's also a place where the first place in the DPRK where they trialed out electronic bank cards.
Yes. Did you get yourself one?
I opened an account. I did actually. Yeah, I did get a card. I don't still have it.
Oh, never mind.
I did open an account at the Golden Triangle Bank.
Okay, there you go.
Which you will visit if you go on this tour as well. Like smack bang in the center of the city, just down the hill from the big Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il statues. You've got this bank, which is one of the first banks that was established in the DPRK. And it allows people to have digital bank accounts like we would in Western countries. Banking still isn't really a thing in the rest of DPRK, but it's kind of a thing in Rason. So that's one aspect that is genuinely different. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, Rason doesn't really differ from the rest of DPRK, at least as far as my understanding of it extends. So that may be the reason why it failed to attract the kind of foreign investment it was hoping to, because foreign investors, I mean, this is a sector I now work in my new job, and foreign investors are typically looking for like strong protection of their investment. If they're putting their money into something, they'll want to know that if there's a dispute between them and a business partner or them and the state, that will be dealt with in an independent way by like a fair arbiter, and that people can't just turn around and change all the rules on them.
Yeah,
and fair. Rason doesn't really have those kinds of guarantees for reasonably obvious reasons. So that may explain why it's not very far along the spectrum as far as special economic zones are concerned.
You might have no idea, and sorry to put you on the spot with this question, but in your knowledge of like Rason and special economic zone and stuff, have you ever come across that kind of situation where a foreign investor, or have you ever heard about foreign investor investing and then kind of getting stabbed in the back by either some kind of business or the state or anything? Or have you, I haven't, that's why I'm asking you. I only know of like a couple of foreign investment schemes and stuff like that in there. And I don't know much. Have you ever heard of anything?
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't have much detail on that. But the episode that springs to mind is maybe the attempt to create a special economic zone in Sinuiju, which happened in about the year 2000.
So Sinuiju is the border city that you usually enter in if you go by Pyongyang and then Dandong. It's slightly south of the peninsula. Yeah, I'm like coming across in a curve. It's basically the entry point where most people go to, the border city to Dandong. Carry on.
Right. Yes, a helpful context. So there was a plan in about the year 2000 to create a proper special economic zone in Sinuiju. Uh-huh. And they even, like very surprisingly to a lot of commentators at the time, appointed a Chinese, so a foreign national, to be like the governor of this area. Yeah. And the idea that it was going to be autonomous for 50 years, and it was going to allow all kinds of freedoms that would attract international capital into the DPRK. Mm. So again, at the time, like, there was a lot of fanfare, like this is going to be achieve what Rason didn't achieve, because it's actually got some teeth to it in terms of the guarantees. But again, like that never really came to fruition. the 50 years turned out to be more like 50 days or something like that, but it actually retained the status. And I think like some of the foreign investors in that lost money.
Right.
And the place to find out more about that is Andriy Lankov's work. So he's written written about that in The Real North Korea, one of his books.
Ah, I think I have. I literally am looking at that book right now. Like it's my bedside reading at the moment. But it's heavy bedside reading, I guess. But I haven't got that far, apparently. Cool. Very interesting. Yeah. And so the moral of that story is to maybe not invest in North Korea at the moment. I mean, it's getting harder and harder with all of the sanctions and stuff like that anyway. So,
right.
Go on.
Well, I was going to say the moral of the story is like, basically, if you are a country that wants to try and attract these foreign investments, like you really need to have some sort of international cooperation that guarantees that they're going to be protected. So like some of the zones we work with, there are international trade treaties, for example, such that like if you undermine an investment in a foreign country, then that country will end up with consequences from like, you know, maybe there were sanctions that might be imposed if they from the partner countries to the trade agreement. So things like that can like give foreign investors more assurance that there's going to be a real sustainability to the new trade system.
That makes sense. So some kind of third party, neutral third party that can help oversee that also they're going to be held accountable for, because it's also like all well and good saying like, yeah, we're going to adhere to these treaties, and then you don't. It's very easy to just be like, oh yeah, no, we said that. But so I suppose it should be a country that, you know, keeps their promises in terms of that stuff as well.
Right. Yeah.
I suppose getting off the economics and stuff side of it, it's actually super interesting. And I'm learning a lot. So maybe I need to get you back on sometime for a whole economics and I suppose history kind of stuff. But we don't have too much time and I don't want to take up all your time. So getting a little bit lighter, I suppose, I've got a few last questions for you you can keep as long or as short as you want, depending on how much time you have. The first thing is sticking on the northeast side of things, pick a highlight, one highlight or one thing that surprised you or one thing that like will always stick in a memory with you, if you have one thing, or if you don't, one thing that you really want to talk about in the northeast, anything like that.
This may seem like a weird one, but it kind of touches on something that people should be aware of if they're going to the Northeast, which is that if you're going anywhere in the DPRK, you need to be mindful of the fact that electricity and hot running water are not going to be provided reliably, other than like the Yanggakdo in Pyongyang, like other places, you can't count on it being there. And that is like even more true in the Northeast.
Yeah.
I spent 8 days in the DPRK and we managed 3 hot showers during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was at the Kyongsong Sanatorium, it's called. So this is like a place where near to Mount Chilbo, the city is called Kyongsong. But it's famous because there are natural hot springs there. So the great thing about natural hot springs, you don't have to rely on the electricity grid being functional for them to provide you with hot water.
Yep.
So I remember, I think it was like after we trekked up Mount Chilbo, we were like, we need to have a shower.
So yeah.
They were like, now it's time for the the hot springs. And we all just like went in. You'll get your own little individual bath and it's filled up with water. Mm-hmm. And after like a long day of having done some like really amazing stuff, just like chilling in the hot springs, having some conversations with the guys like around the outsides of it, feeling fresh, feeling cleansed. Like that was a moment that somehow stuck in my memory.
Yeah. Oh no, that's really good. This is going to sound like a really weird question, but were you the one that got, I remember there was one of us tour guides, were you the one that got electrocuted in Hamhung for putting the rod? Because have you been to Hamhung?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well then it definitely wasn't you. Because so in Hamhung, I don't know why I thought it was you. in Hamhung, I'm going to have to give context for this now. This is a very weird interjection. In Hamhung, you stay on like the beach huts, right? And they don't have any hot water. But what the Koreans do is they provide you with a big, big, big bucket of water, like a massive, you could literally climb inside that barrel. And they've put like this like metal rod inside, which like heats it up. And, you know, as a tour leader, like you presume that you don't need to tell people to like not touch the water or to make sure that the rod is switched off beforehand. But there was definitely a tour leader, like one of us at Choreo, that did that before. Yeah. I don't want to go naming names. But yeah, must
kind of thing I'd probably do. So fair enough, assuming.
To be fair, I almost did it first time as well. But then I remembered, metal and water. Probably electricity and water, probably not a good thing.
Right.
Yeah. Would you recommend going on a set? So you only went on two tours as a tourist. Did you then go on a third one? Or was your third one then a tour leader tour?
So my third one, I transitioned from being a tourist to an assistant tour leader.
Right.
For the 2017 Pyongyang Marathon.
Okay. So, before we go on to that, can I just ask you, would you recommend a second tour? And would you recommend going up to the Northeast and stuff like that?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend getting up to the Northeast. Yeah. And the second tour aspect of it was good for me because it's quite overwhelming being in the DPRK. Mm. You're literally doing stuff all of the time. You're going through museums, you're buying books in the foreign languages bookstore. Like I personally bought an absolute stack. I was like, right, I just need to understand everything.
Even though you're a minimalist.
Read all of these like major works by Kim Il-sung to get under the skin of the psyche.
Right.
So doing it, like rather than doing a massive tour, which I if I could have afforded it, I definitely would have done a massive like 2-3 week adventure tour. But one advantage of breaking it up is that you do have that time to reflect on what you've seen, to go home, like read some of the literature. And then you're kind of like coming back to it. You're reading the itineraries in like a new way with some understanding of what it is you're likely to see. And so you can kind of approach that. Yeah. In a more informed context. Mm. And so that was really valuable for me. And another aspect that was valuable was just the fact that I did two very different tours. There was no overlap. If you go up to the Northeast and do the Northeast Adventure Tour, you're not going to see anything that you saw on the like more standard tours because it's limited by the geography. You can get from that region to Pyongyang, but you're going to have to either get the train, which would be really cool to do, but that's one option, or you would have to fly.
Yeah. Was everyone else on your tour first? You know, it was the first time to the DPRK, or was everyone else second tourists or third tourists?
So for the Northeastern Adventure, there were quite a few that were going back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There was one guy called Pierre Dupont, who is a photographer.
Yeah, good friend of mine. Yeah, yeah. We went to Bhutan together.
Okay, well, he is a phenomenal photographer and filmmaker.
Yes.
He made some amazing films about. I'm surprised that they're not better known.
Yeah,
but if any of your listeners want to, want to see some really good footage of North Korea, like, look up Pierre Dupont. Maybe we can put his.
I'll put him in the show notes. Yeah,
in the show notes. So that's cool. I didn't know that. Was he on one of your tours once or something? So I think it was his third or fourth tour when we were together.
Yeah, he kept going in and out whilst I was still going in and out. So. I think he was in a tour on the way in, on the train is where I met him. But we were in different tour companies. But I, you know, met him, started chatting, and he'd been out in and out several times and stuff. I think he got a bit of backlash from the North Koreans in the end, in terms of the photos he was taking. I don't think they ended up liking them very much. So it was suggested that he... chill out a little bit on some of them, I think, in the nicest way possible, lest he not be able to go back in again. That's where I met him. So, and then we just kind of stayed in touch. So, Yeah, very cool guy though, and I'll put him in the show notes because very, very good photography. Yeah.
There was him, and then there was another guy I remember who I think had made 10 visits just as a tourist at the EPRK.
Wow.
And he was part of the Korean Friendship Association.
Oh, I see. Okay. That must have been interesting.
Yeah. So for listeners that might not be aware, this is a organization based in Spain that is a pro-North Korea international organization. And so it's for people that are like genuine fans of the North Korean system, I guess. I guess that's probably a reasonable way of describing it, although obviously everyone's got their own view, but it's like a pro-Korea, a pro-DPRK organization. So that was definitely like an interesting addition to the tour, having someone that was like a real, he was a real like North Korea anorak. Like he wanted to know all about the trains and like get under the skin of everything that was happening. And he just made it this obsession that he's going to keep going back to the DPRK. So you did get some more experienced travelers on that trip as well, which will add a different dimension to your trip.
Yeah. No, very cool. Very cool. Like, yeah, we were just saying at the start, you meet such characters. And I think that must be true when not only you're going to the DPRK, but you're also going to somewhere so remote, like the Northeast. So it's very cool. Before we end things, I don't want to leave without talking about you then becoming a tour leader to North Korea. Like, how did that come about? Everyone is constantly asking me how I started doing this and how I became a tour leader. So I think it's only fair that now I grill you and ask you to tell in as many or as few words as you would like how you ended up being a tour leader and doing then I think 6 tours in 1 year to North Korea.
So my first ever tour to DPRK was with Adrian Sandiford, who now remains a really good friend of mine. And he knew that I'd been back to do the Northeastern tour. And the thing about becoming a tour leader for the DPRK is that there aren't that many people around that have, one, been to the DPRK more than once. Two, I guess, have some of the skills that you need in order to be a good tour leader, to deal with people well, to be well organized. And three, you're actually in the right place. So you need to be basically living in Beijing or able to access Beijing readily in order to be a tour leader. So I think I ticked some of those boxes to various extents with Adrian. He kind of picked up that I'd got quite into trying to understand Korea and was like really excited about going back. And so he started off by asking me to assist a tour that he was doing. He was running a group for the Pyongyang Marathon. This is a time of year where North Korea has its biggest influx of foreign tourists to take part in that event. So I was like assisting him, and that was how I got my first taste of being a tour leader. And then in 2019, there was, I think it was, wasn't actually the Pyongyang Marathon. It was a different tour. It was in April. They just had a need and they asked me to do another tour, but as a full tour leader myself then. And then it was just like the vibe, I got to know people, and I happened to have a job where I could take some annual leave. And I basically in 2019 used up my entire annual leave to go to North Korea. So I had no holiday at all in that, like actual holiday in that year. Wow. I just went to North Korea 6 times.
You were just in Beijing and then North Korea, Beijing, North Korea, Beijing, North Korea. That is very,
it was epic, yeah.
That's dedication. An epic. That's a great word to describe it. And you look back fondly on your time there.
I look back with memories of exhaustion.
Yes.
But it was definitely something I'm extremely glad I did. And I'm extremely glad I had the opportunity to do. Like, you know, so I really appreciate that Corio gave me this opportunity. There, as I say, like, you know, I'm not part of the Corio core team. I'm like, I'm a sort of freelancer for Corio. So I'm not in the office every day. I've just kind of helped out with leading some tours, but it's a super cool group of people, and they have, like, you know, been willing to, you know, connect and bring new people in as freelancers. And I've really appreciated having that opportunity. So yeah, shout out to the whole Korea team for that.
Yeah, we've got a meeting in a bit, so I'll give you a shout out from I'll give them a shout out from you. What was I going to say before we end? So you look back at fondly, but also in exhaustion. That is exactly the way that I look back at it. I mean, you come back from tour and you just, I can't imagine what it must have been like for you literally going from work to take a break and then doing work, which is like 24/7, you know, someone in the middle of the night has a problem, then it's your problem. So exhaustion right. is definitely one, but man, I'd do it all over again. So how about you? Will you be going back hopefully to North Korea when the borders open as a tour leader, as a tourist? What are you thinking?
Well, if there's a need for me to come back and I'm wanted, I will certainly come back. It's a lot further to travel now than it used to be, but I'm very keen to maintain my connection with the DPRK. I love leading tours. I love meeting people. I love sharing, you know, some of the experience that I've gained from my visits to DPRK with new people. Mm-hmm. And I've made some great connections. Like, I've got some really good friends in the UK now that I met on my North Korean tours.
That's what I found. Like, I've met up with tourists yeah. that I've taken on tour and stuff all around the world. It's very cool.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm very keen to keep, make this an ongoing part of, you know, connections to DPRK, make it an ongoing part of my life. You know, maybe it's a tour a year, something like that. Who knows? But very keen to maintain the connection.
Excellent. I'm very happy to hear that. So hopefully you can join up your next China visit with a potential DPRK opening. Although there's been lots of talk about that recently, it doesn't seem to be like it might be anytime soon. Unfortunately, my bets are still on, although it was looking a little bit hopeful about a month ago, my bets are still on for potentially around like March, April next year. Could be this year, who knows, all bets are off. But yeah, I reckon that it'd be around early into time next year. Before we end, did you have anything else that you wanted to add, that you really wanted to say about the Northeast, or have you said everything for now that has been, that needs to be said? We'll definitely have you back on at some point.
Final thought would be, if you're a listener that is considering the DPRK but is concerned about, you know, things like safety or concerned about comfort, then what I can say is, don't expect the trip. If you're going somewhere like the Northeast, don't expect the trip to be like super comfortable, but it's definitely something that will stay with you for your entire life. Like, this is not going to be, if you look back at your life in 20 years time and you think about what you did, you're going to be really glad that you chose to spend that time doing something meaningful and like going to this really unique part of the world, rather than say like taking a beach holiday somewhere and chilling and relaxing. Like, this is something that you really won't regret. And also, we don't know what the future holds. We don't know what this part of the world is going to be like in 10, 20 years time. So we're sort of at this, what could be quite a unique time in history, where you have an opportunity to see something, to see a system that kind of has that connection to the 20th century that's disappeared in most parts of the world. So I would really encourage listeners to like take a chance and make a visit to a place like this. You won't regret it.
Nice. Very nice final thoughts. Thank you very much for that. And I mean, I think I couldn't make any better closing marks than that. So with that speech, I'll kind of conclude today's podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. It was really, really good to have your insights and just honestly really good to reminisce about what it's like to be on tour and, you know, stuff like that. I really miss chatting about that. So, and it was really good catching up with you. So thank you. Thanks to all of our listeners as well who have stuck around this long. I think it's probably a little bit longer than our normal episodes, but I think it was very insightful as well. So hope you all enjoyed it. And I'll speak to you soon, Pete, and make sure everyone else to join in next time. See you later, Pete. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. It's been great.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.